Welcome to the Speakeasy with Kate Wand, a safe space to discuss liberal ideas.
I had a wonderful discussion with Harry Wade, who is a former engineering student at Western University in Ontario, Canada. Harry became famous overnight when a viral video of him getting dragged out of his university classroom appeared in international media. Harry has recently been expelled from university for refusing to disclose his private medical information. Harry is an extremely principled person who has taken an ethical stance in defense of himself and his classmates. I had the honor and privilege of discussing how a Zoomer like Harry sees the world and where he thinks things are going. And I think that you will find that there is a glimmer of hope in the next generation. If you like, and you're right, actually, that's a really good point, because innovators are people who think outside of the box. And they're nonconformists.
Exactly. That's what I'm cautioning people now. The people that sat silent in my classroom that day, those are your leaders of tomorrow. Those are the professionals, engineers, lawyers, doctors. These are the so-called experts that are going to have our interests and issue the dictates of the future. When they stood by and had a fellow classmate dragged out of the class simply because he wouldn't disclose personal medical information.
So this is a point I'd actually like for you to maybe explain, or I can maybe explain part of it.
Sure.
So when we spoke on the phone, you told me your story, and you basically, it was the first time we had spoken. You said, oh, here I go again. I speak to so many people all day long now. Let me tell you my story. And I was like, oh, I feel actually really bad for you. Like, I don't want you to have to go through the whole spiel again, you know, but you did it anyways. And you gave me your, basically the narrative of what you've experienced over the past few, well, since all of the COVID restrictions really have impacted your education and up until leading to the point where you got dragged out of a classroom for not wanting to show your your papers, essentially.
Exactly.
And this became, you know, published in international media, and like overnight, your life has kind of changed drastically. And so all of that is a whirlwind on its own. But I think one of the things that really stuck with me after our conversation was how people reacted in the classroom to what was going on. And what you explained was that the professor had to step out of the room to get the authorities to come and take you out of there. And so when the professor left the room, everybody, about a third of people you had said had taken their masks and put them down. And you thought that this was people showing solidarity with you.
Yeah, as they claimed to in the weeks leading up to this. Like, I was getting my routine frets, and I would find people in the same places hiding on campus because they've hired all this security and staff to monitor people in the buildings.
Wow.
So I'm hiding in classrooms that aren't being used at all because they're next door to construction sites. And more and more people hear about this, and there are rooms on campus that I'm aware of that I could go to right now, and I would find students working together maskless. And this is the underground, right? And they try and put up their posters on the door saying, we're using this for exams, or there's construction going on, so you can't use this room. Whatever they try to use, but every time I've gone, the room's empty.
It's really like a bootlegging kind of going on
right?
at the universities.
And these are people that obviously I had conversations with, like, hey, nice to know I'm not the only sane person on campus. You want to hear about what's going on with me? Because they tell me about how much they disagree with it first. So it's like, well, let me tell you something. Here are the emails. Here are the warnings. Here's the trespass notice I've been issued. And they're like, oh, that's ridiculous, man. There's no way they would do that. And if they did, I would stand up with you. I wouldn't let you let them drag you out. I would make everyone walk out, or I'd be dragged out with you. And then on the day, just the silence was deafening. And since then, like, nothing. People that I was working alongside with on a weekly basis, sometimes maskless, and expressing their sympathy, don't even want me included in their conversations and have removed me from their groups. And I don't know why, how people can just switch like that. And I'm really concerned that these students are being told something that I'm not, just the same way as that I'm being told something that they don't want the rest of the student body to know about. They won't talk to the press, UWO, And I keep hearing this narrative about how it was my decision. I violated their policies, which were being enforced by the provincial government. But ultimately, they were breaking the law and they were violating my Canadian laws, which is a confrontation I had with a student a few weeks before I was dragged out, who asked me, hey, can you put on a mask? And I said, no, I don't want to. And she said, it's the law. I said, no, it's not. This is the law I follow. And she's like, which law is that? And I said, Canadian law. And she was just disgruntled because people like that, if they don't have the gall to stand up to me, stand up for me, then they also don't have the courage to stand with me. And that's where we're losing the battle.
And so what happened, just to kind of recap that image as well, is that as soon as the authorities came into the classroom to, did they arrest you? Is that, or they?
They wanted it to seem as though it was something that was out of their control and that I would be compliant with it. Yeah. But the conversation that you don't hear in that video from the special constable was that, Harry, I need to take you out. You're trespassing and disrupting the class. The first thing I asked him is, why am I trespassing? Because they've not charged me with anything to do with the mask mandate or my medical information. It's trespassing. But ultimately, the question is, what is the justification for the issuance of a trespass order? He won't answer the question. So he said, if you refuse to comply, I'm going to have to arrest you on the spot. And I said, so be it. And that's when I stood up and they handcuffed me. And that's all I wanted the students to see. And at that point, I was hoping that it would be about them. It'd be about one classroom standing in solidarity with their students. And I hope that would have been broadcasted to the rest of the campus and hopefully the rest of the country.
Yeah.
But it was silence. It was total apathy.
They put their masks back up.
When the professor re-entered and class resumed for about 20 minutes for the time it took for the special constables to arrive, stepped out again because they wanted to conduct themselves out of eyesight of the students. But obviously that was not what I had agreed to. And that's what they were trying to accomplish the day before when they arrested me outside of class, when I was totally unprepared for that. So
I remember when I was in college, I had taken a Psych 101 course, mm-hmm. and there was this famous example of a city block in New York City where there were these high-rise buildings and then there was a woman being raped in the alley, and how everybody just watched.
Bystander effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nobody even phoned 911.
Yeah. Because everyone's expecting someone else to do something. And in the discussion I had this morning with people from CSUN, it's that a lot of people are fanaticizing about what I'm doing, but are insisting that I lead the charge, when it's everyone's obligation mm-hmm. as a Canadian that cherishes their civil liberties granted to us by God or the democratic institutions that you so supposedly value. And then throw those away because you expect a foreigner from a different country to represent your interests for you. It's a total tragedy.
Well, it's funny. I was talking also with a colleague who's a historian at the American Institute for Economic Research. And he was saying that he has this theory and he calls it socialist Darwinism, mm-hmm. where, you know, before kind of the agricultural revolution, maybe pre 5,000 years ago, where people were more kind of, you know, in little tribes and hunting and gathering and doing mm-hmm. that kind of thing, that they had characteristics that were more similar to the characteristics of the outliers of today. So they actually had this kind of interdependence. They had personal responsibility. They looked out for each other, but they weren't exploitative. Mm-hmm. And what he says is that since we've had the centralized state, over time, there have been certain traits and conditionings that have actually multiplied and have divided the species more as herd animals mm-hmm. and as the exploitative minorities who basically control everything. And then there's still that kind of group in between mm-hmm. Of people who are holding on to those inclinations for whatever reason. So I thought that was really interesting.
Right. Like social media institutions for a long time have been talking about how our attention is the product. And now we've become the product. We are the herd. We are the cattle. And not just because we're disillusioned by the lack of freedoms we have, but because we are just a workforce to them. And I'm glad you mentioned Darwinism, because when I spent my year away from school, I read a lot of literature and while I was working at the hospital. And one of the books I was reading then was The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. And in the religious community, Richard Dawkins is a tough name to talk about. And up until now, I've had an atheistic upbringing. I was also referred to read his book, The God Delusion, which is its own interesting case. But The Selfish Gene is what put Richard Dawkins into the public consciousness, because that book came out in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when religion still had a prevalent role in our society, when we were, you know, still talking about issues like abortion in the United States. And now we don't have those talks anymore, because a lot of people took this book, read it, and were just totally disowned by all the good and all the moral and all the virtue that they thought was essential in their country. And then they saw the scientific theory and beliefs about our existence and our evolution. And people are totally detached from the sanctity of what they insist is that we came from a germ pool. But how do you feel now, 7 billion people on one planet, that we're at the same point? We're just in the next step of the evolution. We don't talk about the rights of the cells that constitute our body. We're all just playing a role to support the consciousness that we seem to value at this moment.
Mm.
But now at 7 billion people in a globalized economy and ultimately state,
yes,
absolute control is the only way that economies thrive if they want these issues to be addressed with total uniformity. And that's how they're getting around influencing these people, insisting that these are going to be necessary measures for the future at this very moment.
Right.
In class, I'm supposed to be participating in debates about having climate lockdowns. And that's what's coming next.
Wow. Right? Yes. Yes.
And that's what they're instilling in people my age. And these people are going to be engineers in the future.
Yeah.
And what are you going to say when they start pushing back on all these issues, when we don't issue driver's licenses anymore because we want people to get in these driverless vehicles? Because if you look at the literature right now, it's that driverless vehicles work best as long as there's no human drivers. So AI driving and just about AI everything else just works so much better because we don't have to worry about human interests anymore. And then think about that. All the things that we claim to cherish, all the freedoms that have been granted to us up until this point. Jacob said last night, all the freedoms you think you have, you can exercise in a jail cell. These aren't freedoms that improve your quality of life. They're an illusion, and they substantiate everything else that they're taking away at this very moment. I can have gay marriage, I can have transgenderism, I can have my abortion rights, but I can't go to a restaurant. And nobody wants to address that conflict yet.
Right.
Because right now the narrative is that we're a threat to society.
Yes.
But these discussions are what they're really afraid of. Yes. It's not any sort of mutation or virus or variant that they're afraid of. It's the discussions and it's the information circulating. And that's all I'm providing at this point.
Well, you bring up a very, very interesting point here, is that the people who are standing up for the rights are the people with the ideas that are threatening to this kind of, you know, you might want to call it the woke ideology or whatever the mm-hmm. kind of the uber progressive ideology to move into the new systems of the mm-hmm. future are.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of those things that are incompatible with liberty.
Yep.
And with individual autonomy
mm-hmm.
and with free thought.
Mm-hmm.
So that needs to be quelled.
Absolutely. That's what I really enjoyed about your talk with Bruce Pardee on your channel, talking a lot about, you know, there's just a total disconnect and a total like logical fallacy about exclusionary and inclusionary policies. Like when we're talking about inflating the voting powers of people of color or different ethnic backgrounds because they've been disenfranchised. But now history is just repeating itself.
Yes.
Because give it a couple decades, we're going to be asking ourselves, man, all these colored people have all the power now. Wouldn't it be nice if white people still had a vote or a voice in any conversation when we talk about these woke industries?
Yeah.
Especially as a white male trying to become an engineer. And I'm right. glad that we have more women and people from different backgrounds pursuing engineering fields. But I'm really concerned about all the other male, white male graduates in my class that will be looking for jobs after their graduation and they can't find work anywhere. Because mm-hmm. we've heard it from lots of businesses and institutions that they only want to hire people that portray a diverse portfolio. But the tragedy is that when we pick people based on their background and not their merit, not only is that inherently racism, but we're looking at a future where there is no longer any innovation
right.
because we value image more than innovation
substance.
And substance, right? Yes. There will be no innovation in the future because people that want to think outside the box and have a different opinion are excluded. People are going to be surprised that when they have these accreditations and think they're going to be entrepreneurs, they're going to be answering to someone still, whether that be the industry or the business they work for, or ultimately government, because there's no opportunities elsewhere.
That's very interesting as well, because I think that there's a disconnect with the fact that we haven't completely entered this brave new world yet. So we're teetering on it. Mm-hmm. And so people still have the same ideas maybe then when they go to university, thinking like, I'll be able to come out and get a job. But if you actually value all of those kind of woke mm-hmm. principles,
mm-hmm.
then it will just work against you.
Exactly. Which is why I had no fears about being excluded from the university and academic institutions as a whole at this point, because it was three more years of schooling being talked down to and being discredited openly in the classroom when they invite the students to have discussions about environmental issues.
Yes.
And there's total silence and a reluctance to talk about these issues because one, they have differing opinions that are going to oust them. And two, these are not the issues we're interested in. We're engineers and we're writing about Native issues, Native American issues. And like, I'm pretty sure Canadians and UWO are well known for their social programs. I don't know why this is something that's being forced into engineering fields.
Right.
But these are the discussions they want to have. And this is what we're paying for. Not right. just myself, but taxpayers.
Right.
These are public institutions. These are our innovators. This is what we pay for to improve the country. And they should know that our scientists, our lawyers, our doctors, our engineers are getting social programs.
So this is basically like you could call it maybe neo-Marxism. Mm-hmm. And that's an ideology that is being espoused to all of the institutions, all of academia, mm-hmm. all of the different programs. So if this is kind of what's happening, what do you think, you know, the ordinary citizen who's, you know, maybe a blue collar worker or somebody like that, how do you think it will affect them? What's your take on that?
I feel like we've already lost. My own parents are blue collar workers. They have their own business, but they couldn't conduct themselves without this vaccine. And they stand with me on the issue. But people have their obligations, and that's how they rope you in, right? You have your debts, you have your responsibilities,
yes,
and you have bills to pay. That's the bottom line for them. But you got to think about where these bills come from, especially for young students. Like, I'm already 14 grand in the hole that I owe to the university, and what have I got out of it? I've been expelled.
You've been dragged out.
Right, but think about the people that are going on that have many more years still to go. They're going to be tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And what choices will they have? They will be forced to participate in these institutions that still have these agendas.
Yes.
I don't think there's such thing as like a post-educational institution.
Yes.
I think it's a continuous stream. Because all my life I've been told, don't worry, when you go to high school, things will be different. Disappointment. Don't worry, when you go to university, things will be different. Don't worry, when you get to your professional adult life and you have a career, things will be different. And I think I'm riding that wave of generations that are sorely disappointed and finding they have no autonomy in this field. There is no more entrepreneurship. It's just optics.
Right. And this is actually funny because this is, I think, your generation and the generation younger than yours now, the children,
mm-hmm.
are the ones who are suffering greatly. Because there's also the replacement of jobs with AI. And basically, I think that's a big part of it as well, is how do we, you know, all of the central planners essentially think like they can figure it out. Like, how are we going to how are we going to take care of all of the people? Like, and it's the nanny state, rather than saying, well, you know, people will innovate and they will figure out new jobs that you can't even imagine because you don't have the local knowledge. Right. So they, rather than allowing that to come to fruition on its own, they want to plan everything. And by doing so, they will cause immense damages and people will continue to suffer immensely and see no future. The future will be bleak as long as there are central planners coming in trying to figure it out for them. Allow people the space to define their own journeys and their own career paths and their own lives. And then, you know, everything will work itself out. But I think that there's a double whammy for people of that age category who are kind of in university and trying to figure out where they'll go next. And then now it's like, well, you can't even finish your education if you don't get this vaccine. And if you don't, or even if you've had the vaccine, but you don't actually want to show your proof of vaccination. So you'll be outed from the university and then you will no longer be able to go down that path. So that just kind of adds to the future is bleak. In a sense. So there's the central planning element and then there's that control element. And then God knows what comes next if this is allowed to continue.
Exactly. And it all starts with the students and they're targeting the highest echelons of society, the lawyers, the doctors, the engineers, the scientists.
Yeah.
There's no mandates for people doing minimum wage work, working in fast food or in the restaurants. These are people that handle food that don't have vaccine mandates, but people that sit side by side with each other in a classroom pose more of a risk than the people that handle and distribute food. Because obviously it's not about people's health and well-being. It's about who do we need to exclude and force into the jobs that don't have a say in how we produce and conduct ourselves in society.
Yes.
Which I was the most disappointed with some of my friends that, you know, they rejected post-secondary institutions, but they still chose to get vaccinated when there was no requirement to. Because these people, maybe they don't have the education, they don't have the foresight, nor do they have the care. Right. And that's where they want you. They want you beaten down, they want you discouraged, they want you to have a glim view of the future.
Yes.
And we, like, people want to be forced to sit down and be injected because the fight is just too difficult at this point.
Yeah, and it's also that, you know, when you're kind of, let's say you're 18, you have this kind of individuation that needs to happen from your family of origin as well. And so there's kind of usually some kind of tension there where there's maybe a little bit of rebellion in a sense. And so if you pair that with the idea that, you know, some parents might be concerned, like I spoke with somebody yesterday about this, who was concerned for their 19-year-old to take this vaccine. But they're like, no, like, I'm going to do this because this is also now an act of rebellion against my concerned parent. And it's kind of just my way of being included into social society, because in fact, that age category is the most social age category. Like, that is where you meet your partner, your life partner, potentially.
Yeah.
That is where you actually have an evolutionary reason to be social. And so by targeting university students and people of that age category as well, it's a way of ensuring that they are part of this program if they basically want to be involved in the future at all. And and so it's a really, really, I think that what you've done has been of really taken a tough stance, you know, among probably a sea of conformity, even more so than in some other sectors.
Exactly. Like, even people that claim to be religious, we're losing because they claim to do it for this people's well-being, such as their families and their friends, who will feel safer if I inject myself with something that I don't agree with. But what I've told them is that, one, you're not serving them. Two, it's totally contradictory with the doctrine that you seem to abide by, which is that we don't, you know, consent to feeding into people's delusions. God and religion, at least the texts I've read, you know, part of worship is being wise and being insightful and questioning authority, not giving in to people's fears and expectations for their own sake. Mm-hmm. We can do a lot more and serve people that we care for by assuring them that maybe what they believe is wrong and that there is a different perspective. And giving in just to make people feel better is why we're in this mess to begin with. And that doesn't apply just to religions. That's everything else. That's marriage, sexuality, abortion, all those sorts of things. Yeah. I don't know how we have conversations about abortion when having talks about miscarriage are still taboo and difficult for most women.
Yeah.
So I don't see the difference, really. Ultimately, it's a loss of life and it's a tragedy. Mm-hmm. But here people think it should be allowed, but it's still a tragedy for some other people.
Yes. And I think there's also, like, if we want to dip into that a little bit as well, the abortion has been a lot of the part of the progressive program over the last few decades, mm-hmm. and the sexual liberation movement and all of that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. But it's been treated almost like an alternate birth control, mm-hmm. rather than being treated as, you know, something that is kind of like to be considered heavily, mm. and weighed heavily, and to really understand, you know, to do this cause benefit analysis, exactly. in a sense. But, and how can you even when it's something that involves something far more spiritual, mm-hmm. than, you know, just that kind of cause benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. But there's no education that can, I think, prepare women for that in the sense, and in the sense of how it's given now. And so those are all the kinds of elements, I think, is maybe what you're coming around to, mm-hmm. that that land us where we are, that mm-hmm. that create kind of a landscape that's rife, mm-hmm. for this kind of illiberalism and this kind of, it's that mm-hmm. that loss of spirituality, that loss of mm-hmm. of soul.
Exactly. Academics can't answer these difficult questions. Like information, statistics, those kinds of figures. Who decides what number justifies actions? And to me, numbers are just numbers, ultimately. What about the morals and the ethics?
Right.
Like the only numbers in the Bible are the commandments.
Right.
Not because we have numbers that say once we reach this limit, we have cause to substantiate all the things that are now being imposed on us, including reproductive rights, is what abortion is really all about. Conditioning people to believe that governments have a say in people's reproductive organs.
Yeah.
Which, as we've seen in China, is what they've done and they're still doing. Yeah. They lifted it a few years ago, but not because of the interests of their people. It's because they realize that their population pyramid is heading for a disaster and they've lost all their middle class working age people,
yeah.
that are ready to retire, and there's no young generation ready to replace them.
Right. So, and then the state loses, doesn't
exactly,
it? They're no longer reaping the mm-hmm. fruits of the labor of the, mm-hmm. of the citizens.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. when we talk about environment and classroom, one of the three factors that is always pushed on us, apart from climate change and globalism, it's population. But we always dance around this issue of population, mm. because they're not prepared to have this conversation about population control.
No one wants
yet.
To say it.
No,
no one wants
exactly.
to say it. Yeah.
Nobody wants to acknowledge it, but we roll out these freedoms related to contraceptions and abortions, and we're just being conditioned,
yeah.
to believe that, you know, we should take a greater interest in academics and our professional fields, when really the view of the state is that an overpopulated region or country is burdensome. And that's the issues that they're looking at in East Asia, Central Asia, and Africa in the near future.
Right.
But they're not worried about these issues in the West, because either we've got it under control or they have a plan already in place for it.
Right.
Which is, we're pushing these notions that in order to be included in society, you can be gay, you can be trans, or you can be female. But the reality is that young working professionals, when we talk about this pay gap, this wage gap between men and women, it's just part of the businesses that you're fighting against. And those models have been in place for a long time because that's how those businesses thrive. But when we criticize why we have pay gaps between men and women, you're inviting government to have more control over business.
Yes.
And that's obviously a tough conversation. Like, I'm just an engineering student, and that's all I thought I was going to be 2 weeks ago. But now, I love philosophy. That's what I spent the last year reading into. But all these things are interrelated.
Yes, like they are.
Gender equality, pay gaps, abortion, reproductive rights. It's all moving in the same direction, but we're not connecting the dots. We have this diverging view, which we're going to meet up against. Because if you've ever heard of the horseshoe theory of political science, is that whether you're on the extreme left or the extreme right, you're going to meet in the same spot, which is total control, total totalitarianism. Because that's how these institutions believe they'll thrive, is that we need total control in order to accomplish the things that we've set out.
Yes.
And people believe that. People believe that people that dissent and disagree have to be excluded in order to make ends meet. And for now, that issue is to do with a virus, which is mutating coincidentally every season. But when Canadians and hopefully the rest of the world has had enough, it's going to be the environment. And we've already spent too long these last couple of years thinking this is an acceptable action for the government to take, to have a say in not only every other aspect of our lives related to our well-being and health, but also whether how we are included in professional institutions and whether or not we can participate in basic services and human welfare, these services that they provide to us that we're going to be excluded from. Right now, it's about travel. You can't go to different provinces or leave the country very soon. But soon it will be about you can't apply to welfare if you're unvaccinated. You can't buy a driver's license. You can't get a driver's license. Yeah. All these things that are real freedoms. I can't remember the term Bruce used last night, but there's freedoms that are inherent or integral that are just given to us. And then there's other rights and freedoms that are provided by the state. And those are things that we're supposed to agree on. But I don't remember taking a vote to take away the rights of people that can shop here or participate in this business or go to school or work. So why do people still think we're in a democracy? We just had an election and everyone voted for this party, but we didn't vote on issues totally unrelated to what liberalism is about. Or at least that's what I would hope Canadians would have thought at the time. For people like us and everyone else, we know that liberalism isn't just about gay rights and social welfare programs. It's about what is good for the greater good. And people don't forget how similar that sounds to communal good or for the commune or for the community, right?
The greater good, I would argue, doesn't exist, because how can you qualify it?
Exactly. Especially in states such as our own, where we have state-enforced atheism, we have an insistence on this scientific perspective of evolution.
Yeah.
And if you read The Selfish Gene, which I mentioned earlier, there's winners and losers in evolution. And for now, if we all agree on this, people that you want to call unvaxxed or anti-vax, like myself, and people that are pro-vax, evolution has its part to play. And if people stick to their beliefs, then they will succeed. I choose not to accept this vaccine, but I'm a Zoomer, just like everyone else in school. I have my fair share of vaccines already.
Yeah.
It's not about a vaccination issue. It's about freedom of choice. And especially as that relates to evolution, animals, humans, all evolving organisms on this planet have decisions to make about not only their welfare, but their offspring. If these people are right, then they will see the fallout of my decisions and they will see that unvaccinated people are dying en masse. And we should have sympathy, as always, when people are dying for reasons beyond our control. But that doesn't mean we limit everyone else's freedoms. If anything, it's just an indication that people are insecure about taking the wrong decisions.
Right.
But that doesn't happen in nature.
Yes.
You don't see the jaguar envious of the lion because they had a different evolutionary strategy.
Right.
It's competition and people have to find a way to thrive.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge for people in my position. We're not allowed in most mainstream jobs or academic institutions, but now I'm receiving invitations from other clients, from other firms, from other institutions that like that I prioritize my personal beliefs that are going to play a role in every scientific decision and not just these social courses that I'm being forced to take, courses on presentation and communication, courses on the environment. It's, and even in, before I was in civil engineering, I think every engineer has to take this at some point, but I was in biomedicine before that. And there's ethics as well.
Yes.
And like when you see the professor of ethics at the institution you're participating in resigning, how does that not send signals to you?
Right.
And you have to have these sessionals come in. 2 out of my 5 professors were not the same ones I had a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where have they gone?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure these people were enjoying what they were doing. They had their tenures and they had comfortable, cushy jobs, but I think they took themselves out of the picture.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to be confronted with
students.
Or maybe
they were put out of the picture as well.
That as well. But you know, don't hear that story.
This is a really, something I'd like to tie in here is, so you're studying engineering, or you were studying engineering, and that's kind of, who do you want to be building the buildings that are going to hold you, that are going to, mm-hmm. you know, keep you safe, keep you secure? Mm-hmm. Do you want to have the engineers who are under duress of some sort, whether they've realized it or not, and who have maybe been selected? This comes back to the other points you're bringing up, who have been selected not for what they can do and not for their ideas, but for maybe what gender they are or what intersectionality group they fall into, mm-hmm. or, you know, because they've been double vaccinated and they're willing to be conformist. Are those the people that you want building your buildings mm-hmm. at the end of the day? Like mm-hmm. this.
Right. And like, I'm only a second year student, but there's so many issues that are going to be related to this broad idea of how much control the state has and how we want to conduct ourselves as a society. And just an example, one of the issues that we talk about in civil engineers is how we deal with waste. And up until now, we've just been shipping it and making it someone else's problem.
Right.
But
most people don't know this. This is a really good point. I read a great piece about that, how all of the recycling, the composting, mm-hmm. all of that, a lot of that is virtue signaling.
Exactly.
In fact, and it just ends up getting shipped off to other countries because mm-hmm. they don't know what to do with it. And then it just ends up getting burned in big piles and causing pollution.
Exactly. And people are disillusioned and think that the people in my classroom now are going to be the people that stop this from happening. When the reality is, this has been going on for decades.
Right.
And the people that are in my classroom now are the same people making those same decisions. Because again, it's not about welfare. It's not about the right decisions. It's about what makes us look good right now. And that's the image we're putting forward.
Yes.
It's not students that have individuality, that have freedoms, that exercise free fall on these campuses. It's about uniformity and having people all on the same page, because these are undisputed facts in their eyes. And that's going to be related to all issues, not just viruses that we're confronting right now.
Social posturing. And you don't want to have those people actually building things for you, because they may not even know what to do. Or, you know, like this comes down to having people who are leaders, right? Like those are the people who you want making the decisions. So for example, like in aviation, the worst accidents happened because they had kind of authoritarian expert type pilots back in the day. And there was some very serious cases of that. And so then they kind of revamped the whole program, where they said, well, you need to have a leadership role, an authoritative role as a captain,
mm-hmm.
but you need to also talk to the rest of your crew. And so all of these kind of systems were set up. And then if you look at the recent history of aviation, mm-hmm. has been fantastic, yeah. right? And this would apply, I think, to all kinds of fields where you need to have somebody who is kind of in charge of a project, but mm-hmm. not dictating the project,
mm-hmm.
right? And so those are actually natural leaders. And sometimes it's kind of like you may be one, it sounds like. So you've been kind of put into this leadership role just because of the principled stance that you've taken, and people are coming to you now to see what to do, but you're like, I don't really want any of this. Like, I don't, you know, and then those are the people who actually make the best leaders, the best politicians, you know, are the kind of rogues. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I can think of a couple that I know.
That's what I've been told this morning. Like, Harry, I would vote for you because I can tell you don't want to do it. And that's great, because like it's an ego game out there, right? And it's vicious. And that's something I feel completely unprepared for. And seeing the climate now, like things you say a decade ago can tear down everything you've worked towards.
Right.
Which is why if I considered becoming a member of the public and running in public office, I don't have those sorts of fears, because ultimately I'm just making myself available as an option, because I can't leave this country behind in good conscience, not knowing that I didn't at least provide the option for these people, that they are not choosing at this point. They haven't chose their own doom, because I really question the integrity of our elections at this point. I was astounded that we continue to vote for a party that has implemented this up until now. And next year we have provincial elections, which I'm trying to get a fast track crash course in provincial politics, but yeah. That's where I hear that's where everything's at. It's yeah. provincial.
Or and municipal even, you know, but provincial, yes, that's where kind of most of the, anyways in the last, you know, year and a half of the public health dictatorship, for lack of a better term, or aristocracy, like that yeah. has been really happening at the provincial level. But there is a big federal kind of hand puppeteering everything at the same time. So mm-hmm. they're kind of working in cohorts with each other.
Exactly. So. I think that's the way it works best, right? Ford is just the front man. Yeah. He's taking the heat on the yes. issue, but ultimately he's answering to someone. Yes. And that's not even necessarily Trudeau. I'm sure Trudeau answers to someone as well.
Yeah.
But these are the special interest conspiracies that we are just kept out of the loop from yeah. when we're meant to be in a totally transparent democracy.
We don't have to look that far, though. So, you know, like, for example, a lot of people who I've spoken to who are kind of, you know, of the majority viewpoint and have just decided to kind of do everything that has been suggested or, you know, that they've been told to do, and they've kind of followed the program that's supposed to lead out of COVID. Mm-hmm. Those people don't really, they kind of wonder, like, why would the government be against us? Like, what do they have, you know, mm-hmm. to gain by, you know, just doing anything that wouldn't be in our best interest? And then you just have to kind of look at the different interests that come up in all of the tales over time that we've looked at in our lifetimes, you know, mm-hmm. like you think of Lord of the Rings or something like that. So you have people who do really get consumed by power. That is something that we've always known. And then there's also people are very incentivized by very large profits. And those profits, which also allow them more power, because basically then you're able to do more with that. And you can leverage that money in different ways to continue to grow your dynasty, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Because there are many people now who are actually kind of more powerful and wealthy than governments. And they happen to be very buddy with big pharma. Mm-hmm. And so if you just look at that, like if you're just the regular ordinary person, and you just think a little bit about that, like, why do they want to mandate vaccinations on everybody? Mm-hmm. Like, why?
It's obvious. Well, to me, it is, right? Like, those are the easier talks, really. I think people can put at least those two together, because we live next door to at least a freer healthcare system, and we've been very critical of healthcare in the South, but like, we only have one healthcare option in this country, and we think that's the best option. Like, I come from the UK, where we're looked to as an example of flourishing health, public healthcare. It's not, but mm-hmm. at least there's a two-tier system. There's still a private option.
You have private and public. Mm-hmm.
We don't even have private here.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's illegal to practice privately at this yeah. point without any, you know, because mm-hmm. then you wouldn't be part of the institutions.
Exactly. And that's the only way to make money, right? Like, we pay per dose, and we paid for like 300 million different doses
yes.
just for Canada.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure we're only around 40 million people. That's more than four doses for every single Canadian in this country.
Yeah.
And we're already talking about the yeah. third dose.
So profits is a really kind of easy argument for people who don't really want to like get into the deeper kind of thought about it. But if you and I want to go a little bit there, please, as well, I think that there's also this social credit system that is kind of looming. Mm-hmm. And this is attached to, like you're saying, the AI, and, you know, are you going to be able to have a driver's license and all of those things. So basically, if you have everything centralized on one smartphone app or something like that, that you're then able to say, okay, well, if you're a good citizen, mm-hmm. then you can take part in these programs. that we're going to offer you, because we're going to have to come and help you, because we know there will be no jobs left for you unless you're part of the institutions of academia and of government and of the things that now all of the people who have followed our ideological program are part of. None of the innovators will be left, as you're saying, and none of the dissenters, none of the black sheep, they're all gone. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't, like, obviously it's concerning for everyone, but again, like, this isn't a model that thrives, at least not in nature. If this is what we're heading towards, this is what dystopia looks like, because we're in a suspension of disbelief when we talk about apocalypse. The, what was it
erated? The climate apocalypse?
Not that apocalypse. The apocalypse where people lose their individuality and their liberty. Right. And there's plenty of dystopian novels that I don't need to mention, but that is the ultimate outcome, because some people genuinely believe that is the best outcome. Because when I spoke to my friend a year before this, cautioning him on this is our future, and we're talking about the best government models, and at the time I was pushing a narrative that I was totally at odds with, simply because as an atheist I could confess that this is probably the best way to do things, but it's an awful future. And what I was talking about as a hive mind is that one person calls the shots, and we don't have to worry about the destructive interference of different interests. Because when somebody picks wrong, whoever picked right will prosper and flourish. And that's what has got us this far as humans on this planet, is that natural decisions, natural pressure has decided the best outcome. But when there is no competition, there is only one winner, but there is also only one loser. And there's no discrepancy between that when there's no competition, because we're all going to be in the same boat and there's only going to be one person at the top. And at which point you may as well just consider the entire human race as one organism. For now, we're just trying to confront the issues of today, which is possibly overpopulation, famine, disease, the environment, all these fear-mongering issues, to push this notion that this is the best way forward. One leader, one mandate. But that's not what got us this far. We prosper because individual ideas are allowed to compete and winners come out on top. And now I seem like the loser, but I stick by my decisions. And I'm totally optimistic that I will come out of this a winner. And I just worry for everyone else that is going to lose in this, because I warn them, give it a couple years, you're going to look up one day and realize you don't like the world that you live in now.
Right.
And COVID is a hard topic, at least when I was working in the hospital.
Yeah.
So I often talked about sexuality. We have gay, we have trans, what's next? And what is being entertained right now is pedophilia.
Yes.
And that's,
yes.
People think right now, there's no way we would ever agree to that. But a few decades ago, it was trans, and
it's already being put on the into the programming.
Mm-hmm.
If and you look at these different things on Netflix and things like that,
exactly.
And this all comes from the same literature. Like, actually, the guy who had I forget his name. I will look this up and I will kind of link it below. Mm-hmm. But the I think it was maybe in the 50s or 60s. The original kind of ideas for pedophilia and transgenderism were kind of like linked together by this. I don't know if I can even tell you this story. It's so grotesque, but do you want to hear it?
If the camera can handle it.
Okay, yeah. So, well, it's basically that there was this, there were these twins. And of course, there's always experiments on twins. And so basically this man said, well, this one has some kind of a deformation, which, you know, is up for debate. I don't think that was what actually happened, but found a legitimate reason to convince the parents that this boy should have a sex change to a girl while they were still an infant. And then the man monitored them as they were growing up. And one was growing up as a boy and one was growing up as a girl, and I won't tell the rest of it, but I'll just maybe link the details below. But it actually comes from the same kind of group of thought and the same academic school, the same academic groups, you know, who were kind of bringing up these ideas decades ago. And this is the postmodernist kind of ideas.
And what, I don't have an answer to this, but this is the answer I was giving people. Because after all, I'm just a 22-year-old engineering student. I don't take social science. But I would hope if there was anyone in those classes with integrity, they would come out and say what I'm thinking right now, which is that why would we be pressuring people to embrace pedophilia and grant sexual freedoms to people that aren't sexually developed? And I think the direction we're going in is that we want to make young people, young impressionable people, seem like they have more of a say in the conduct of society. However, as we know, if you're a parent, that these children aren't equipped to make those decisions. But eventually the question is going to come along where if these people are old enough to have sex, then these people are old enough to have voting rights. And if we give voting rights to very young, younger in ages, that's always been the notion in liberalism, the younger and younger people we want voting. If we give them sexual freedoms and all other kinds of liberties and vaccines now, we can have children override the consent of the parents. They can get vaccines. They can be injected with experimental drugs. And now we can give them their sexual freedoms. Let's just give them voting rights.
And this is why every ideological movement has like their child propaganda puppets, like Greta Thunberg. And there was like David Suzuki's girl. I don't know. It was in the 1970s when they had the first kind of climate summit. There was this propaganda child as well. And so they always have that, you know, the Nazis had their propaganda children. And if you can indoctrinate the children and, like you said, give them all of these so-called freedoms, which are really just privileges being given to children who could not have the potentiality of understanding, then we end up in a very, very dangerous, even more dystopian place.
I find Greta very entertaining. I think where we're lost, and like, I was brought up with this mindset, like, I don't think, like, it's been going on for decades, but obviously there was never a year in my life where we weren't talking about climate change, and that's the new norm. But I can accept, as someone that has studied in a scientific field, that yes, perhaps man-made activities are changing the climate, but ultimately the question is, so what? Like, they have beliefs about disastrous outcomes for the future, and that may be so, but we will just learn to embrace those challenges. But how can we embrace those challenges when we're casting people out of academic institutions that disagree with any notion about the extent of climate change?
I thought about this actually in a really kind of common sense way when I was a very young child. I had this thought that I don't think humans will ever be a problem for the planet, because the planet got rid of the dinosaurs when the dinosaurs were no longer good for it. And that was kind of just a random thought that I had. And so I find it's just so hubristic to think that we have all of this power. That's what it comes down to. Like, anthropogenic climate change, yes, the debate is not settled, but it appears that it's such a minuscule change, if any, that we're causing. Like, they're not these entrenched permanent changes. But the fact that this has become part of the propaganda model and the indoctrination, and interestingly, all of these environmentalist kind of ways of thinking, you know, they've been going on forever, but especially at the kind of fall of the World War II kind of central takeover of everything and the central planning notions, it was like, well, let's talk about the environment. So it was kind of like a way of all of those things to kind of pass under, like everything was kind of formed in the same time, like the United Nations, I think was around like 1946. The World Wildlife Fund, the all of the different organizations that spoke about climate, they were all just post-World War II organizations that sprang up. So you have to wonder, you know, there's a great book. It's called The Green Reich. And it talks about all of this kind of like the the anti-humanistic environmental roots, you mm-hmm. know, and how far that goes.
I think the Cold War is what got us as far as we did, because like I said earlier, there was a competition. There was competing ideologies.
Right.
And people were doing their best to succeed. Mm-hmm. And I guess when the wall came down, there was some kind of backroom deal, because I didn't see the West creep into the East. It seems the East has creeped into the West.
Wow.
And yeah. we could have had a very different history, because in 1945, Winston Churchill put on the table, after we take Germany, let's keep going and take the rest of the Soviet Union.
Mm.
And we would be living in a very different world mm. because odds are the West would have won that war, and it would have been a lot shorter than the Cold War, because nuclear weapons weren't in the arsenal of the Soviets up until that point. So they would have lost that war. And in decades earlier, we would have had one regime in control of the planet. And it was a democracy at the time.
Yeah.
But we have all these democracies, but we're all doing the same thing.
Right.
So how much longer can people continue to believe that all these different democracies are lining up on the same issue,
right.
even though there's so much diverging information out there.
Right.
And when countries do take a different stance, like Sweden and I think Taiwan is what I heard, is that they've pulled Pfizer, is that they think they're just as dangerous as AstraZeneca and Moderna, which they've pulled.
Hmm.
And we don't hear these stories, right? We're focusing on exploding variants in Africa. And it's no coincidence they chose Africa, right? Because they're worried about African Americans in the States that are rejecting this vaccine. They want to make it seem...
And South Africa as well. Like, they've also kind of rejected the whole thing, I think, as really? Far as I can tell. Like, the program. They're just like, we're just not doing this.
They should. They know yeah. apartheid better than anyone else. Like, we don't want another two-tier system based on yeah. something you can't even detect now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, how do you enforce that? Yeah. Other than putting labels on people's arms.
And again, you know, this whole thing, it's really funny because aviation, I always say, is like the canary in the coal mine of this whole thing. So they were kind of the first to go down, and they're still suffering. Like, their industry suffered 85%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were left at like 15% of former capacity, and it's kind of fluctuated ever since. But it's really interesting because, again, they've said, oh, we have a new variant, shut the borders again, close down travel. And this as well is kind of in the playbook of the Brave New World, where mm-hmm. ordinary citizens there are too many carbon emissions being allotted for them to travel internationally. Like, mm-hmm. this should be a special privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have all of these kind of things that are unrolling, you know, in the background. Like, mm-hmm. there's this program called CORSIA, which is carbon offset schemes for aviation reductions and emissions. And they've created this program pre-COVID that would become mandatory in 2027.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the prices for aviation fuel would quadruple, and like, they would have to basically commit to all of these regulations that would make it so that it would be insanely expensive for the regular person mm-hmm. to get on the plane. And that, you know, was a product of relatively free market and innovation, you know, especially in aviation. It's been an industry that's innovated over the decades,
mm-hmm.
and they've been able to have a bigger capacity in their aircraft, and to yeah. make it more affordable for people, and yeah. for the, you know, so that's mm-hmm. also part of that program.
Yeah. I spent most of my high school career wanting to be a pilot, and not just because I'm an engineer, but I do know a lot about aviation. And
hmm.
what I hear is that as soon as it started, they had to get rid of half their fleet because it was too costly right. for them to maintain it.
Right.
And if you know anything about production of these planes, like, these orders take years to fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
And people pretend that there will be government bailouts for these airlines, but they're only going to bail out the frequent business flyers and the politicians that are yeah. jet setting more than anyone else.
Well, what they've done is they've actually done green strings attached bailouts. So like Lufthansa, Air France, KLM, it's been that they have to reduce their fleet, that they have to reduce their voyages. Like, if it's under 2 hours, they have to promote rail voyage, like mm-hmm. Taking the train instead of a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these different conditions, like Lufthansa had partial state ownership in order to be bailed out.
Yeah.
So full on fascism. And then you have Canada. They actually just left the void. They just let it let it croak. And now it's really funny because you've had the federal government has come now and bought a bunch of shares at Air Canada, which has been, you know, so rather than doing their partial state ownership, they've just become one of the bigger shareholders. And then Chrystia Freeland recently, the deputy prime minister, was saying, oh, well, you know, Air Canada's CEO isn't bilingual, so shame on him. And so now she's starting to, they're trying to get involved. So the government will, it's not just on COVID that they will be, you know, in your living rooms, but it will be about every single part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Right now it's aviation because it would take years to build up the fleet to the amount of flights we were having before COVID.
Yes.
And it's going to be way more expensive. And we've already created a wealth divide, taking people out of work. And there's meant to be a labor shortage, but you've taken out a tenth of the workforce. So it's on you. And that's what they want, right? They don't want people flying anymore. And that's the truth. And next it will be the cars.
Yeah.
And then it will be everything else.
Right.
People, wherever you live, that's where you're going to work. You're close to this job position, that's where you're going to work. Because you can't fly, you can't drive, you can't even leave the province. So
maybe even your town.
Exactly.
Maybe even your home. You know,
exactly.
There's something to be said about that too with carbon emissions, right? Like even walking, breathing, taking your bicycle. Like if CO2 is the problem, and this is Driugo Defridi, this is his thesis, then man is the problem.
Exactly. And do we even want to talk about streaming? Because like, I'm pretty sure I heard 30 minutes of streaming is equivalent to 5 miles of driving. So now that we're all on Zoom, we're protecting the environment supposedly because we're not commuting into work and we can all work from home. But aside from the Zoom aspect, all these social media platforms that circulate videos, so we have TikTok, we have Netflix, Twitter, YouTube.
Yeah.
That all costs CO2. That's all electricity.
Don't give them any ideas, Harry.
You know what? You're right. Because then you're going to see one state media, social media platform.
Right.
And that's the only option, right?
Right. And then you can only watch it, you know, or maybe you can only watch your other, you know, that are kind of like the shadow state media. So you don't actually know that it's state media, but it is state media. Like, you can get your privileges for that if you've been a good citizen.
Like in Fahrenheit 451 or what's that guy? What's that movie with the Guy Fawkes figure? Remember the 5th of November. What's it called? It's played by the guy from The Matrix. Anyway, again, fantastic movie. They put it on Netflix. I hope it's still on there. And I'd recommend everyone watch it. Yeah. Same thing. There was some incident that happened in London, England a few years prior. Some medical catastrophe. Some virus got out. And lots of people died. And all of a sudden, there was only one state media. And there was a total hush-hush about the control of information.
Oh, is that that new movie that came out?
No, like, it's not new.
It's an older one.
It's not that old. It's fairly modern. And like, it's so relevant. And I find a lot of the books I was reading over the summer really relevant. You mentioned The Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah.
And then after that, I read a book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He's the guy that wrote The Gulag Archipelago and A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, if you didn't know.
Yes.
He wrote about the gulags.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I have those. I haven't read the second and third gulag, but I've read the first one. It's such a hard read. You're like, okay, I'll need a year to recover from that one.
Yeah. One of his other books is called Cancer Ward, and it's about cancer treatment in the Soviet Union. And you had this paradigm where you had people that were informants for the state, and descendants of the state being treated, receiving the same poor treatment just because of where they were located.
Wow.
Because they identified a region in the Soviet Union that they didn't want to provide adequate care to because they didn't want these people thriving or surviving.
Wow.
And then compare that to how we have narratives being constructed about unvaccinated people not receiving medical treatment.
Right.
And that's a hard issue for people to talk about, even vaccinated people.
Yes.
Which is why we also get talks about putting us in camps, because then they can just give us whatever treatment they want away from the public eye, the same way they don't want to talk about people being cast out of academic institutions such as myself.
Well, let me tell you about something that I read about this camp that they've actually put up in Saskatchewan. And they did this a while ago. And then kind of I looked at their website and there wasn't really, like, it's on the governmental website, but that specific page. It explains all of this, and it's basically a prison. But what they happen to talk about there is they talk about people as patients, even though they're not sick. Mm-hmm. It's for people who may be a close COVID contact and things like that, who can't isolate. And what it comes around to saying, they end up talking a lot about Indigenous people. They say, call the Indigenous hotline. Like, it's actually a paper that's meant for kind of the employees to read. And it's just like out there publicly, but nobody really knows about it. And so then you think like, well, this is interesting. So there's like, you know, some problems with opioid crisis in those communities and Indigenous people and having drug and alcohol problems. And then they have this kind of camp, and then all of the wording begins to make sense. Like, it's for people who can't properly isolate, you know, maybe because they're homeless. And then they give different kind of indications as to what the reasons might be. But you look at this and you're thinking, wow, so they've actually set up this kind of prison where they describe it as a prison. You're in solitary confinement 24 hours a day, except for the 1 hour a day that you're able to leave your room to go into the common area, but there's nobody else allowed in the common area at the same time as you. They say for the workers of this institution, the governmental employees who work there, they do not need to wear PPE, so they don't need to wear masks or anything like that while they're in their areas. But anytime they go to give food to the people in their room for them to eat, they have to put on full hazmat suit PPE. So these people are basically there. It's like an asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And this is insane. It's an insane asylum, and it's an insane idea. Mm-hmm. And what's so aggravating about it is that you have all of these people who subscribe to the doctrine of this woke ideology, who say, well, what about all of these Indigenous people? Every child matters. And they put that orange flag out and they talk about all of these atrocities. Mm-hmm. And then you have these kinds of things happening. And you wonder, first of all, what makes you think that it's not still happening? Mm-hmm. There have been reports of like vaccine distributions that have been kind of akin to what happened that everybody was outraged about, where the white people came over and made the Indigenous people sign an X on the paper, got them drunk, and then took their property. Mm-hmm. So they're doing this now, it appears, mm-hmm. with vaccines.
Yeah.
And so all of the same things are happening that outrages people, but yet they will turn a blind eye because they are not told this by the propaganda media.
Exactly. And all within less than a year, we uncovered a mass grave out in BC full of all these children from these, what are they called again? The schools?
Residential schools.
Residential schools. I didn't learn about that in the UK, but mm-hmm. I got educated on that in Canada.
Yeah. We learned about that. Like, I learned about that when I was young in school. So it was all basically older news that has now been used as propaganda to basically, again, to separate the people. And it's used as kind of, I think, like Canada's version of Black Lives Matter.
Essentially.
Right.
The movie I remember is called V for Vendetta.
Oh, yeah. That's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
I saw that a long time ago. Yeah.
For those that don't know your history, it's about Guy Fawkes. Well, they make comparisons to Guy Fawkes, right? And that was because Catholics at the time, living in the UK, were being persecuted because of their beliefs, because they had a Protestant king on the throne at the time. And the chaplain I went to see last night, he did an excellent expose on how British history and how it parallels with how we need to advocate for these religious fundamental freedoms that have persevered and preserved Western society for so long. And now we're at this point where we're completely, it's all fabricated. And we have these misnomers about how there is no white culture and that every other culture is more valid than white culture.
Yeah.
I wish I knew more about that history, because those are the conversations which I really think will change minds.
Yeah, yeah. This is what we hope to achieve on this podcast as well. So I hope you will come back.
I will. I'd love to come back. I need to get some historians on here. But yeah. I got some time on my hands now.
Yeah.
And the people we want to be learning about is William of Orange, who came from the Netherlands to England.
Yeah.
And that started...
Yeah, I remember that
Protestant name. Reclamation, I think is the word. Yes. Because we had the Protestant Reformation under Henry VIII because he wasn't happy with the papacy. and the Holy Roman Empire up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we had wars with Spain, where yes. we had a Catholic nation dissenting against a Protestant nation. And there were religious wars fought yeah. over there. And that's where, actually, that's not the Crusades. Crusades are a different issue. But I think this is an important part of history because that's the justifications that are being used to discern between different creed exemptions. I was having conversations with people beforehand. People that are Catholic are not getting exemptions, but people that are Orthodox and Protestant, I don't know about Protestant truthfully, but people that are Orthodox are.
Really?
Because the reasoning is that the leader of the Catholic faith has stated that vaccines are for the communal good. So
yeah, he's leader, a commie. He's a true commie.
Right?
Radical.
And I have Catholic friends that have buried their heads in the sand and think it's okay that they have to be told to worship from home and every Sunday right. gather in front of a screen
right.
instead of gathering as a community, which is the whole purpose of those faith institutions, or yes. so I thought.
Yes.
But the church I went to last night, like, they're Protestant, and I've never been more proud to be English on that issue because I've only had my spiritual awakening in the last year. But I always have my skepticism about Catholics because, one, it is a very bureaucratic way yes. of having religion.
Yes.
When religion is meant to be a personal union. Mm-hmm. And at least my personal belief on it, my perspective is that all I can validate is what I think. And that is where God comes from, truly. And if you've ever heard people draw attention to the fact that on top of the Sistine Chapel, the mural by Michelangelo of Adam and God, God is encapsulated in the shape of a brain. And that's where my beliefs stem from, is that God comes from your consciousness. That is the gift that he ultimately bestowed upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are forfeiting that at this moment
mm-hmm.
for a collective consciousness and letting people choose right and wrong for us because we think we can be excused from that role. And people of the religious communities that think they are doing this because they have to because of their religious obligations, because they have leaders in their church or because of other followers of the same faith, they have to do it for their welfare. That's not true. And there's different doctrines in Christianity, at least, that are totally contrary to that.
Yes.
God, as far as I understand it, and what I want to believe is that it's a personal union.
Yes.
And it doesn't come from whatever someone says from the church or from the Vatican.
Yeah.
And that's what we've lost. And, right? Go ahead.
And I'm just thinking, this is the reason why every totalitarian society needs to remove God and the institutions that come with God, because that God is your consciousness, I think, as you said, or your conscience, really. Mm-hmm. So, or it can be something else, but it is basically your soul, your conscience, all of those things that actually separate you from being an animal, mm-hmm. in a sense, like from not being a herd animal.
Exactly.
It is your relationship with God, which is your conscience, maybe your acts in front of that higher power, whether that higher power is something that's just within your mind or actually exists,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really matter in the mm-hmm. sense that your actions to your conscience, to that little Jiminy Cricket, you know, yeah. are what should be the most important thing, and not your eyes in front of anybody else. And that includes institutions, and that includes your friends, and that includes your extended family, and that includes everybody except for basically that it's your soul. It's your inner relationship that you have with yourself and with the higher power of yourself, whether you want to call that God or anything else. And I want to read something to you on that thought, because I was looking this up earlier and it's linked to so many things that you're saying. And Carl Jung, he had talked about what happens when you have this society that loses God and has this God-shaped hole. And that's when you move towards collectivism and state religion. And he also, I came across this in a great little book he wrote the other day. What's it called? The Undiscovered Self. And he talks about also statistics. So I'm just going to read this to you. Mm-hmm. And then I would love to hear your thoughts on it. So he says, we ought not to underestimate the psychological effect of the statistical world picture. It displaces the individual in favor of anonymous units that pile up into mass formations. Science supplies us with, instead of the concrete individual, the names of organizations And at the highest point, the abstract idea of the state as the principle of political reality. The moral responsibility of the individual is then inevitably replaced by the policy of the state, raison d'état. Instead of moral and mental differentiation of the individual, you have public welfare and the raising of the living standard. And this is kind of the goal and meaning of individual life, which is the only real life, no longer lie in individual development, but in the policy of the state, which is thrust upon the individual from outside and consists of the execution of an abstract idea, which ultimately tends to attract all life to itself. The individual is increasingly deprived of the moral decision as to how he should live his own life, and instead is ruled as a social unit and amused in accordance with the standards that give pleasure and satisfaction to the masses.
You'd think information like that would be enough to change minds. And I'd love to know where you get this stuff, because I love all the video essays you do your channel. They're fantastic. But what can I say? You've hit the nail on the head.
That was Carl Jung. He did it. You know, he lived through that, right? Like, so he was able to actually reflect upon that and somehow put it into words.
Exactly. The only freedoms they care about giving us are the ones that you can exercise in a cell. They can put us in camps, and I'm still allowed to be gay or trans or whatever else, but I still don't have all the other freedoms that vaccinated people are allowed to exercise right now that I'm not. Because numbers are easier to manage when they don't have their own liberty, right? So when you become a number, and we don't have to look far back to find out how we treat people as numbers.
Yes.
And that's, I think we're already there, and that's the tragedy. Like you said, people in the quote excuse themselves from their conscientious obligations, either because they think I'm going to solve the problem for them, or they think I'm part of the problem.
Yes.
But that's all I'm inviting people to do, is to wake up and start using your conscience again and just start asking relevant questions. Simple as, if your vaccine works, who is in danger? And if your vaccine doesn't work, why do I need it?
I think this is a great place to leave our talk. We could go on for hours, but I think that let's leave it there. Harry Wade, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure.
Thank you, Kate.